Welcome back to the show. I'm Travis Chappell, and I believe that if you can connect with the best, you can become the best. So after creating 800 podcast episodes about building your network, I've come to realize that networking is really just making friends, if you're doing it the right way anyway. Join me as I make friends with world-class athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, entertainers like Rob Dyrdek, authors like Dr. Nicole LaPera, former presidents like Vicente Fox, or even the occasional FBI hostage negotiator, billionaire real estate mogul, or polarizing political figure. So if you want to make more friends that help you become a better version of yourself, then subscribe to the show and keep on listening, because this is Travis Makes Friends. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the show. Today, I am making friends with Guy Kawasaki. Guy is one of the first marketing experts at Apple from the 1980s. He was there in the room during the Think Different campaign, which was really what turned Apple around at the time. Right before the Mac and the iPod and all that kind of stuff, Apple was actually in a lot of turmoil. A lot of people were thinking that it was going to go downhill, but their marketing department came out strong with the branding of Think Different. And that campaign ended up being wildly successful. Guy was one of the people responsible for that campaign. And he's one of the people really responsible for popularizing the term evangelist within the marketing community and first starting there at Apple. Now he is currently the chief evangelist over at Canva, which is a multi-billion dollar design software created out of Silicon Valley. He's a Silicon Valley investor, entrepreneur. He's an adjunct professor of business at UC Berkeley. He's written 15 books, several of which ended up on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list, as well as the New York Times bestseller list. One of the things he's most famous for, and really the first time that I was personally turned on to his content, was the top 10 or the 10 slides included in a pitch deck. So when I was raising money for my company, you know, you got to put together a deck and pitch investors. And Guy Kawasaki has really popularized this idea of 10 slides in your pitch deck, no more, no less. Here's exactly what to put in them. And here's the point font you need to use. Here's the max number of words, and really responsible for simplifying the pitch deck. And if you search Guy Kawasaki, in fact, one of the top recommendations is Guy Kawasaki, 10 slides of a pitch deck. So that was the first time that I had heard about him. And then I ended up reading a couple of his books and then come to find out he has an amazing podcast called Remarkable People. And so this book that Guy and I are chatting about on the show today is called Think Remarkable, which is what he's learned from chatting with the hundreds of remarkable people that he has had on his podcast as well. Guy is quite literally just a wealth of knowledge dating all the way back to the 70s and 80s. He's been in rooms and speaking with some of the world's most brilliant innovators, thinkers, authors, experts. And he's really figured out a way to distill all this information. So my producer, Eric, and I actually got on a flight, went out to San Jose to do this interview in person at Guy's house with a beautiful view of the ocean in the background and all that kind of stuff when we were walking up to the house. And he could not have been more welcoming. So Guy, thank you so much for coming on the show. For those of you that are watching, I can't wait to share this episode with you. So without further ado, here's my conversation with the one, the only Guy Kawasaki.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. That's your camera right there behind you to the left. Thank you so much for taking the time, man. It's a pleasure to sit down with you. Been reading your stuff for a very long time.
You don't look that old.
I guess long is a relative term, right?
Okay.
So let's go back in time before we jump into some of the tactical, practical things and talk a little bit about how you got to this point in your career. And before we do that real quick, if you are watching, listening right now, before we do anything else, go pick up a copy of Guy's new book, Think Remarkable. He's interviewed hundreds of remarkable people on his podcast about remarkable people, and then distilled a lot of that wisdom and put it into this book. And it's a fantastic guide to get you where you want to go. So Think Remarkable, head over, pick it up wherever you're going to pick it up. Go buy it right now before we do anything else. And now let's reverse clock.
So does he say that about every author that comes on, or just me?
Just you. Only you. Just you, Guy. No. All right. Back in time. Let's say, pick a number here, 7-year-old Guy.
7 years old.
Set the scene for me, Guy.
62 years ago.
Let's do it.
I was born and raised in Honolulu, Hawaii, a lower middle class family. And, we lived in a really sort of, Hawaii is a great place, but, anywhere you live, there's good sides and bad sides. And so I had a very pleasant upbringing. You know, it's not like I had to overcome poverty and I was starving and didn't have clothes. My parents are great parents. And in the sixth grade, believe it or not, this teacher tells my parents that I had too much potential and that I should be taken out of the Hawaii public school system and put in a private school system so that I could go to college. And knock on wood, my parents listened to her and did it and sacrificed. So I got into a college prep school. That led to going to Stanford, and Stanford led to meeting the guy who hired me at Apple, and the rest is history.
Wow.
So in a sense, I owe everything to that sixth grade teacher because, you know, I might not have made it out of Hawaii, and you know, who knows what the world will bring. Which kind of reinforces Steve Jobs' commencement address, which is you can only connect the dots looking backwards. Right. Who knew? Who knew what she, the changes she was catalyzing in me?
And big props to your parents for listening.
Yeah.
And taking some action to do something about it.
I'm telling you, you know, back then, I'm third generation Japanese American.
Okay.
So the first generation came to pick sugar cane.
Okay.
The second generation, my parents, they, you know, real estate broker.
Okay.
My father worked for the fire department, you know, that kind of stuff, but not picking sugar cane.
Yeah, right.
One step up. And both of those two generations did everything for my generation. So that's why I got to go to this college prep school and then go to Stanford and, you know.
What do you view as the responsibility of each generation in a family?
Well, each generation is different, right? So the first generation is survival.
Yeah.
The second generation is educate your kids. The third generation is don't screw up on what they sacrifice for you. The fourth generation, yeah. And, you know, seriously, like sometimes I think about, listen, again, I didn't have this really like horrible poverty that I overcame, this Horatio Alger story, right? I certainly wasn't spoiled. But now, just because of the work of my grandparents and my parents and good fortune, you know, working for Apple, my kids are never going to have to worry about, you know, the stuff that we worried about. Yeah,
right? Where the next meal is coming
from. Yeah, they never have to worry about that. They may worry about what is the next meal.
Not too many options is their problem. Yeah.
And so you think, you know, I'm a big fan of Angela Duckworth and grit. So how is the fourth generation going to be gritty?
Yeah.
You know, like force them to take violin lessons or something.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. Is there anything that you tried to do in that to give them a sense of a chip on their shoulder in some regard, right?
You know, you try to communicate to them that the world doesn't owe you anything, right? But it gets harder to do that. This is a high quality problem. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Sure.
I mean, it's a high
champagne
quality
problems,
problem,
but yeah, but a problem nonetheless.
I do think about it, and listen, you know, the concept that you are in control, that's a delusion. You're not in control. And if any of you are young parents and you think, you know, you know exactly how you're going to raise your kids and what's going to happen, well, let me tell you something. You're in for a surprise.
That's me right now. I'm a young parent. And my son is 4 and my daughter's 3.
Yeah.
So anytime I sit in the presence of somebody who's actually raised kids and gotten them out of the house seemingly and done a decent job at it, I like to selfishly ask the question, what's your best parenting advice?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, you're going to find this a little strange, but my parenting advice is you should have more kids.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why.
All right.
Because right now,
lay it on me.
When you had one kid, you could double team the kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you're playing man for man.
That's right.
All right. You get any more kids, it's going to be zone. And that's when it gets interesting. And we have 4 kids.
Okay.
So they're double teaming us. That's when it gets interesting. And I think, you know, people who are only children, they have a very different outlook on life. Oh. And even one-on-one, but when you get 4-on-2, you learn that you got to have some grit.
Yeah, yeah. It teaches the parent grit or the kid's grit?
Both.
Okay. All right. So the advice is have more kids.
Yes, that's go okay. Tell your wife, you know, I went to California. This guy said his best parenting advice is have more kids.
I'm sure she'll love that.
Well, we adopted our last two.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we wanted to like have a girl for sure. And then a couple years later, the agency calls up and says, well, the same parents had a baby boy, you want him too? Yeah, why not?
Wow.
In for a penny, in for a pound.
No kidding. Yeah. In the best way possible, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So once I get the four kids, then what do I do after they're there?
You got to ask somebody else.
Got it. Or just read this book.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know about
that. Hey, there's a whole section on grit in here. So I'm going to need a lot of that, it sounds like. Okay. So let's.
You know what? There's one person that I interviewed. Her name is Dr. Dana Suskin.
Okay.
And she has this project that it's something like, I don't know if it's 3 million or 30 million, but you got to, from the moment your kid pops out of the womb, that's when learning begins. It's not pre-K. It's not K. It's the moment they're out. So they did some study, and I forget the number. It's either 30,000 or 30 million. But the kids who have been interacted with from day one do much better. Vocabulary, intelligence, developmental. So you got to talk to your kid a lot. And it's not a matter of simply turning on baby Einstein and say, okay, watch baby Einstein and you'll be fine. You got to talk to your kids.
It's the humanness of it, the interaction, the connectivity.
There's no shortcuts to parenting.
Oh, man. If I've learned anything, that's definitely one thing. Yeah. You can't outsource parenting.
You know, the days of them listening to you is declining rapidly.
As their age increases and social media increases.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, man. All right. So have a lot of grit and basically just try to figure it out. And that's the best you can do.
That is the best you can do.
All right. So let's get back into the story here. So sixth grade, teacher makes a big impact on you. You get put into private school. Did you enjoy school
growing up? I love school.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy like the social aspect of it, or were you just always a learner?
I went to an all-boys school, so it wasn't that social. Yeah. But I tell you, coming from Honolulu, you know, the sort of the horizons career-wise in Honolulu, if you're really successful, you get to run the department store at Ala Moana Center, or you run a hotel or something like that.
Something in hospitality.
Yeah, hospitality or agriculture, right? That's basically it. And then you come to Stanford, and it's a whole new world, right? And it's like there's Hewlett, there's Packard, there's Intel, right? And these are not companies that have 200 employees. I mean, they have tens of thousands of employees, and when I came to the mainland, the scales were removed from my eyes. My horizons got so much bigger, so much broader.
Yeah.
I hope everybody, you know, if you're listening to this in Hawaii, send your kids to the mainland. I mean, it's a whole different world there. So.
You seem to have always had a spirit of curiosity about you that has carried into your entire adulthood, even to the point now where you're continuing to put out books and to do podcasts and to interview people and produce content and things like that. Is that something that always existed?
Well, always is a long time, okay? And I think always is also sort of retroactive. And whenever I hear people interviewed and there's a question like that and they say, you know, I always wanted to be a businessman or always wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer, I think they're full of shit. I mean, I just, you know, I mean, Listen, I don't remember what I wanted to do at 7.
Sure.
I can barely remember what I want to do right now. And and I think that it, you know, it's like you go through life and there are things that you find interesting. Not passion, interesting. Mm. And I think you just got to scratch a lot of interesting things. And then maybe one or two or three over your lifetime will become a passion. Mm. But I think we do a great disservice to people when we say, you know, you got to find your passion. Mm. It's as if you're going to find this one thing magically, love at first sight, and boom. I don't think it happens like that. I think, you know,
they're developed.
Yeah. And often by accident, right? Mm. I mean, who knew that maybe your Asian parents want you to be a doctor, lawyer, or dentist, but then you discover psychology, or maybe you want to be, you know, Roy Yamaguchi's in my podcast and he started Roy's Restaurants, right? Mm. So, you know, did his parents say, oh, I wish our son was a chef? I guarantee you they wanted him probably to be not doctor, lawyer, or dentist. But here he is, Roy's, right? So I think that's just the way it is.
Curiosity is kind of the prescription that helps you develop those things.
Yeah, and it, some parental, you know, advice. I don't think you can force your kids to love something. Hmm. And you should listen. Angela Duckworth, the mother of Grit, mm-hmm. tells a very funny story about how her father was really the one that was pushing her. Right? Like, you got to be a doctor. And she says, no, I want to start a school for disadvantaged kids. So the story she tells is, so I told him I wanted to be a teacher and do education. And so the next day he comes back and he says, okay, you want to be in education? I want you to be Secretary of Education for the president. Like, Dad, I just wanted to teach kids. Right, right. I think that's not good.
Yeah, sure, sure. But what about getting them to try things, though?
I think that's the growth mindset, right?
Yeah.
And so there's two kinds of growth mindset issues. So one is you don't think you can do anything better. Like, you have this fixed mindset that... I cannot do this. Yeah. I'm not naturally talented. I don't have a gift for writing or a gift for music or whatever. So, you know, I give up. I'm just going to stay in my corner. There's also this fixed mindset that, let's say you're really good at violin. Mm-hmm. And so you have, everybody tells you, you're a prodigy, you're brilliant, you know, you're going to go to Juilliard at age 10. And you can also develop a negative fixed mindset in that now you're so used to people telling you that you're a prodigy, you're great, you're natural, you're talented, that you don't want to try anything that might risk your reputation and image. Mm-hmm. So I'm really good at music. I'm not going to try surfing because I'm going to make an ass of myself surfing, right?
Yeah.
I think that's just as bad. And you never hear about that. Mm-hmm. You always hear about the people who don't want to try anything, but right. Both are a fixed mindset. And so I think for kids, I mean, they have to do a lot of sampling.
Yeah.
Because you just never know.
How do you know as a parent when your kid is disinterested in something versus they're getting to the part of doing that thing that's just really difficult?
Yeah.
And they're wanting to quit before they move past that part.
I don't know. And if any parent tells you they know, they're bullshitting.
They're lying, yeah.
Well, Angela has a very interesting rule in her family. It's called the hard thing rule.
Okay.
So everybody in their family, the kids, had to pick one hard thing. And they had to pick it.
Got it.
And then they had to require effort to master it.
Mm.
And she said, listen, if you find it, you know, you're not interested or whatever, you can quit, but you can only quit on a high note after you finish something. So if you're taking viola,
mm-hmm.
you can't quit after two lessons.
Yeah.
You got to go the whole series, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't mean you can quit only when you've been to Carnegie Hall, but you can't just quit because you're frustrated one day. You got to quit on a high note.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good rule. I wish I knew that rule earlier. Yeah, I'm telling you.
No, that's a great one. That's a great one. That's
so exactly when your son says, you know, I want to try tennis. You say, okay, you're trying tennis, but I'm telling you that you're going to go through this whole, you know, summer tennis program. You're not going to quit in the middle of the summer.
Like if we decide to start down this path, then you cannot quit until you've reached at least this point of the path, essentially. Because that's the thing, right, is everything's going to be hard. Even if you might enjoy that thing, it's still, well, like what you talk about in the book that Mark Manson talks about, who's also been on the show, is like, it's the shit sandwich that you enjoy.
Yeah.
Is when it starts getting that bad. That
when Mark Manson told me that, the light went off. I said, you know what? Like, you're a podcaster, I'm a podcaster, right? So I spend hours preparing for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
We do a lot of editing. We take out all the filler words.
Okay.
You know, it's not just press record and take that and go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of shit work in podcasting. Mm-hmm. And if you're a writer, there's a lot of shit work in editing. And you got to edit and edit. And, you know, you're sick of reading your draft, right? And people from the outside, they look at that and they think, oh, to be a writer, you just, you know, you get your, you're at your beach house and it's a windswept beach and your kids are all straight A. They got like 1600 SAT scores. They're trying to pick between Dartmouth, Yale, and Stanford, and the house is clean and the food is all ready. So you go out and you get your Mont Blanc fountain pen with your 18 karat nib and you get the parchment and your novel flows onto the page. Yeah. That's not how you write.
Yeah, not quite.
Write is shit work, man. But I mean, I heard somebody once say that who was a writer, and he said that the only thing worse than writing is not writing.
Hmm.
That's what it's like.
Hmm. When you find that thing.
When you find that thing. And I think a lot of people, there's this concept called ikigai.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And ikigai is this Japanese word for like your calling in life, your reason for getting up in the morning. And I think the Western world has kind of misinterpreted it. Now, I'm Japanese American, but I'm basically American. Okay. I don't want you to think I studied with the Shinto priest, so I got all this insight. Okay. That's like bullshit. Okay. But I'm
got it.
I'm telling you. So many people say, you draw three circles: what you like to do, what you're good at, and what you can make money. And what's in the middle? That's your ikigai. I have a different attitude. I think you will know what your passion or ikigai is when it's something that you're not good at and you cannot make money. And if you do something like that,
you would do it still.
You would do it still.
The paycheck didn't come in.
Like, I don't know about you, but I don't make a cent from my podcast. My podcast is a big negative hole.
Yeah, it took me a long time to make some money from it, for sure.
Right.
About 600 episodes.
I only have 400 more to go.
Yeah, exactly. I think this episode will be like 912 or something like that. So it took about 600 to start making some money.
From. And yet you did it, right?
Yes.
And it obviously wasn't because it was easy money.
Of money. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You can eliminate that as the motive.
Right. Yeah. That's for sure. No. Yeah. I think every podcaster right now is agreeing with us from this perspective for sure. Okay. So let's go back in time to the story here. Okay. So you come to the mainland and go to Stanford. At the time, correct me if I'm wrong, Stanford wasn't as Stanford as it is now, meaning that like this is pre-dot-com era. This is pre-Silicon Valley investor boom era.
But you know what? I went to Stanford in 72. And there was Hewlett and Packard already, right? I mean, there were examples of tech startups that 10, 20 years old, as opposed to started in 1910 with, Goldman and Sachs in the Depression. So it was, you could still see it. I mean, it may not be the dot-com mania.
Yeah. But what was that? I guess my question is, was that the fuel that made you decide on Stanford? Was something about getting into tech or computers or anything in that? Or what was the push behind that?
I could bullshit you. Okay.
Okay.
So I'm at this school in Hawaii called Iolani.
Okay.
And it's a college prep school. I swear to God, I don't know why I applied to Stanford. I applied to Occidental, University of Hawaii, Stanford, and Northwestern.
Okay.
So I got into, I think, every one of them. And so I love football in high school.
Okay.
So I could have played football at Occidental because it's, you know, it's this tiny private school, right?
Was that like a D3?
Yeah, D4, I don't know. Pop Warner. <Yeah. laughs> So I could have played football there. And so I wanted to go there because I love football. And my father said, you know what? If I'm spending all this money to send you to a mainland college, you're either going to Stanford or you're going to go to University of Hawaii where it's free.
Mm.
Those are your choices.
Yeah, yeah.
So I picked Stanford.
Narrowed it down for you.
Yeah. Now, you know, if you want to look back and say, oh, guy, you made this really conscious decision to pick Stanford because of the potential of the engineering department and being in Silicon Valley and all that. God bless you. You can believe that. I'm telling you, the reason why I went to Stanford is my father said, it's Stanford or UH, son. Pick one. And that's why I went to Stanford.
That's the one that made it. So what ended up being your major there?
Oh, that's another great story.
All right.
So I, like many Asians, I thought, I'm going to be a doctor. So I take this course at Stanford where you walk around the medical center on what do you call that? When the doctor goes on, God, that's how little I know about medicine.
Residency?
Yeah. No, well, not the residency, but they go, it's like a tour. They rounds.
Rounds. Gotcha.
Yeah. So you go on rounds with the doctor. And the first day I do this, I freaking faint. I swear to God. So I said, you know, God's telling you something.
This may not be
for
me.
This may not be the right thing for you.
It's like blood or something?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I was out.
Something visceral happened, though. Yeah.
God was sending me a message. And so, you know, there goes medicine. And then I thought, well, you don't want to stick your hand in people's mouths the rest of your life. So there goes dentistry. So my father was a senator in Hawaii, no college education. And so I went into law. And then I went to law school for 2 weeks and I hated it. I couldn't stand it. So I quit law school. I went back to Hawaii, worked the rest of that year, came back and I got an MBA at UCLA. So. You know, if people want to think, oh, guy, you had this strategic plan, you know, you go to Stanford, you learn psychology so you can be an evangelist, and then you go to work for Apple, and, you know, I hate to tell you.
Yeah, it's not how it works.
No,
if
I hadn't fainted, I may be a doctor today.
So then you get the MBA. Business was just kind of something that you thought you might get into?
I loved it.
Okay. It had a decision to be in this world, at least in some capacity, right?
Well.
did you jump out of school and like, let me start a business?
Okay, so here's another great story. So the UCLA MBA program was a 4-day-a-week program.
Okay.
So fifth day, you don't have school.
Right.
And as I said, I came from a lower middle class family, so I had to work. And so I started working and I met a woman who was from Hawaii and she worked for a jewelry manufacturer.
Okay.
And she needed someone to help her count diamonds. So some people work in a library. I worked in the jewelry company counting diamonds. Mm. And I worked there for the 2 years I was in my MBA. And then when I graduated, they offered me a job in sales and marketing.
Got it. Okay.
So while all my buddies were going to Wells Fargo and McKinsey and Goldman Sachs, I went to this company called Nova Stylings in downtown LA, schlepping gold and diamond.
There you go.
And now you say, okay, guys, so you just screwed up your career. You know, you should have gone to Wells Fargo or whatever and, you know, and make up fake accounts. But anyway, so... So I go to the jewelry business in sales and marketing and understand this wasn't retail. So we didn't sell to, you know, Trixie and Biff getting their engagement ring. We were selling to Tiffany and Cartier and fine jewelers. And selling to those people is very difficult. Mm. I mean, because they're
very sophisticated liars.
They're very sophisticated is one way of putting it, but they stick it to you. Okay. It's a very tough business.
Yeah, yeah.
Gold and diamonds are expensive, but at some level, it's a commodity. Mm. And, you know, you could take this ring, throw it on a scale. It's okay. It weighs X grams. It's 18 carats. So it's 18.24. It's gold. The spot gold price today is whatever it is per ounce. There's like $16 of gold there. So I give you $20. I mean, I let you make, you know,
right, right.
25%. So that's the toughness of the jewelry business. So
right.
Being in sales and marketing in jewelry taught me how to sell. And I'm telling you, there's only two real functions in life. You're either making it or you're selling it. Everything else is bullshit. And so I learned how to sell, which, come to find out, is what I had to do for Macintosh. Mm. So, if you want to believe the guy, you had a plan. You knew you wanted to be in tech sales, so you went into the toughest kind of sales you could find, jewelry, to prepare yourself for Apple. Yeah, again, God bless you. You can believe that. But this is all just dog shit luck.
Joining the dots.
There was no plans.
Yeah.
There was no plan.
Another part of your book that I really appreciated, and it's easy for me to appreciate this part because I did 5 or 6 years of door-to-door sales when I started in my career as well. But you mentioned that in the book, that your first job should be selling.
Yes.
Is that something that you recommend to basically any young person?
Well, unless you're a nerd and you can make something. Hmm. But I mean, fundamentally, I don't know about you, but I think life is sales. I mean, it may not be trying to get Tiffany to buy your ring, sure, but it could be you're trying to convince the person checking you in at United Airlines to give you an aisle seat in first class and upgrade you, right? I mean, you're selling. When you apply for a job, you're selling. You're not buying. Well, maybe some people are buying, but most people are selling.
Right.
And so when you're dating, you're selling. I mean, when you're telling your kids to do something, you're selling. Mm-hmm. If your lips are moving, you're selling.
It is a skill that will take you into every single part of your career afterwards.
God knows if you're a founder of a company and you need to get everybody behind your vision and to make the product and sell it and support it, you're selling. You're convincing people to believe in your dream.
Yeah.
It's an essential skill.
Right. Right. No, definitely. Okay. So do you recall enjoying that job?
Jewelry business?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you making pretty decent money comparatively to like other people your age at that time?
I was making more money than my friends at Wells Fargo.
That's what I was going to say, right? It also pays you. That's the thing that I liked about selling was that it's a earn while you learn business where you can come in and learn a lot and increase your skill and get better at communicating and persuading, but you also get some pretty solid paychecks along the way if you're picking it up.
You know, my wife also began in sales for Procter & Gamble.
Okay.
And they really know how to train you in how to sell, right? So selling Tide and, you know, putting Tide and Bold in some podunk grocery store is not a trivial task.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great skill. People underappreciate the ability to sell.
Yeah.
And that may be even more true today because, you know, a lot of people in tech, their idea of selling is, we need to do A/B testing. Does the blue text sell better than the purple text? You know, if we put the picture in the front or the side, that's not selling. Selling is hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
okay, so, so a couple of years you're doing sales and marketing for this jewelry brand. At what point do you decide to jump back into the tech world or jump into the tech world, I guess, for the first time?
Well, I knew that, you know, the jewelry business is a very small business.
Yeah.
And it's generations of jewelers, right? So you don't have a breakout company and there's no startups in jewelry.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Not like Silicon Valley startups. So I wanted to get into tech and I had to make a transition, and I went to a small software company because it was the only tech job I could find. And then my friend from Stanford hired me as the second software evangelist in the Macintosh division of Apple. So,
and this was late 70s?
This was 1983.
Early 80s, okay.
So I am living proof that nepotism can work out, because I'm telling you, on paper, psych major, dropped out of law school, majored in marketing for an MBA, schlep gold and diamonds. You would not put those things on a resume and say, that's the guy we need to evangelize Macintosh software. Look at it. Perfect background. He's been selling gold and diamonds. Like, and this is a true story. So my friend, as I go through the interview process at Apple, he says to Steve Jobs, so what did you think of Guy? And Steve says to him, yeah, he's okay, but I want you to know, if you hire him and he screws up, I'm going to fire you too. that was my...
Hey, well, it says something about that guy that he liked you enough to bring you on board anyway, right?
I guess.
Yeah. Oh, man. So real quick before we move on, I got to ask this question, because you were in both of these places and now you live up here in Northern California. But you went to Northern California for undergrad, and then you went to Southern California for master's. You stuck around there doing Julie and everything. Which one did you like? Which one did you like better? SoCal, NorCal?
NorCal.
Obviously ended up
NorCal has the action in terms of entrepreneurship. And LA, God, every time I go to LA, I get robbed. I swear, once my wife and I took our baby son and we went to LA, Beverly Hills, you know, we met Rene Russo and, you know, this kind of stuff. We got robbed twice.
Are you serious?
Our car got broken into twice in LA.
Oh my goodness.
Now, if you can just stay west of the 405.
Yeah.
And north of the Harbor Freeway, maybe.
Yeah, maybe you're good.
If
you
could just stay in Santa Monica.
Okay. Well, even then anymore, I don't know. Yeah. Okay, that was just a selfish question. Okay, so now we move into the Macintosh part of the story. You tell a story in your book about being in the room for Macintosh Think Different campaign.
Yes.
Which this, correct me if I'm wrong, but this campaign combined with kind of a new design for the iMac basically saved Macintosh. Because at the time, like, it sounds glorious to be like, oh, I worked with Steve Jobs at the beginning of Apple, blah, blah, blah. But this is when people were saying Macintosh is going to go bankrupt. You should probably be putting out your resume to other people. And then this whole thing turns the tides. The iMac comes out, then the iPod, and obviously the rest is history. But you're in the room for this. And I'm not going to steal your glory. Can you tell that story?
Yeah,
about what happened there? Yeah.
So this is about 1997, and I'm an Apple fellow and chief evangelist of Apple. And Steve was on his way back into the company. So he was already a presence on campus, but he wasn't CEO yet. Anyway, so there's a meeting of all the marketing people. Well, not all, but, you know, the top 10 people or whatever. And Lee Clow from Chiat Day comes in and shows the Think Different commercials. This is the ones with Gandhi and Amelia Earhart and who else was it? Einstein, Picasso. And the pitch was that if you think different, you're going to be an achiever. You're going to be innovative. It's not the people who all think the same. They're not the ones who change the world. It's the ones who think different.
The remarkable ones.
They're the remarkable ones, right? What a name for a book. Think Remarkable. And so he shows these commercials and we love them, right? Truly captures our spirit and what it means. And at the end of the meeting, Lee Clow says to us, I got two copies, Steve, of these commercials. I give you one and I give one to Guy. And Steve says, don't give one to Guy. This is like in front of 10 people, right? And I say to him, Steve, is it because you don't trust me? And Steve, as only Steve would, says, yes, I don't trust you. Now, these are the kind of moments in your life, like, you know, you don't want to look back and say, Why was I such a wimp ass? Yeah. Why didn't I tell him off, right? So I said to him, Steve, that's okay. I don't trust you either. It probably cost me $50 million, but...
yeah, man, I thought that was a great...
Tell your kids not to piss off the CEO of the most valuable company in the world if they can help it.
Yeah, if it's within your control, probably don't do that.
Suck it up.
That's a good lesson to teach, yeah. I got to imagine a plethora of stories that you get asked about a lot with those kind of early stages of building the most valuable company in the world. Are there any others that come to mind that bring kind of like this, the nostalgic feeling of like, man, those were tough times, but also really great times.
They were great times. And listen, working for Steve Jobs was an honor and a privilege. And I would not be where I am were it not for Steve Jobs. I don't know anybody who worked for Apple who says, you know,
yeah.
It did me harm or...
Well, know. I like the part in your book where you said, be an asshole that...
Mission-driven.
Mission-driven, yes. Yeah, thank you. Be a mission-driven asshole. And basically you said, I didn't know anybody who didn't think Steve Jobs is an asshole, but I also don't know anybody who doesn't count it as an honor and a privilege to have worked with him before him.
So, I mean, it's not clear to me that you have to be an asshole to be Steve Jobs' kind of impact, yeah, caliber, right? Sure. But I think many people, they figured out the asshole part. They haven't figured out the visionary part. You know what I'm saying?
Fair. So, like, yeah. True.
There's a lot of assholes, but there's not a lot of visionaries, and there are very few visionary assholes.
Right.
And so it was a great experience, and, you know, I lived in fear of him. I think everybody in the division lived in fear of him, mm-hmm. that someday he would just rip you in public or he would humiliate you, because we saw it done, right? Mm-hmm. And contrary to what you might believe, that's a great motivating factor. Like, mm-hmm. the fear of being humiliated,
sure.
is a powerful force.
Do you think that that's a healthy thing for a culture to feel that way about the...
Well, leader? I mean, as we sit here now in 2024 and, you know, employees are, they don't want to even come into work. I mean, they want to telecommute from Bali. I mean, you know, I would like to see somebody tell Steve, I cannot come in. I want to work remotely in Bali. Yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah. Bro. Right. That was your last day.
Yeah. But he just had such high standards that you learn to expect more of yourself.
He was on a mission.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to be on that mission, then great. Go do that.
And you know what? I mean,
else, but...
it was never a mission about... There are CEOs that you can tell the mission is to glorify them. Mm. Steve Jobs wanted to change the world. He wanted to make people creative and productive. He wanted people to buy millions and millions of Macintoshes. It wasn't about him. Mm. It was about that. And that's what makes him a mission-driven asshole as opposed to a regular asshole.
There's been several biographies, a few movies that have come out depicting Steve Jobs and who he was, the early days at Apple and all those things. How accurate or inaccurate are some of those depictions?
I don't go see those movies and I don't read because... You know, when you had PTSD, you don't want to revisit it. Like saying, how many Vietnam veterans go back to Vietnam? I don't.
You don't go in search of your triggers.
Yeah. I don't want to get any seizures or anything. So, but I believe that when they tell these harsh stories, mm-hmm. they're true. He was very hard to work for, very scary kind of guy. But. What is the negative about that is that people read that and they take away the wrong thing. They think, oh, I want to be the next Steve Jobs. And so let's do research on Steve Jobs. And everybody says he was an asshole. He drove either a 911 or an S-Class and he didn't ever put the plates on because he thought the plates were ugly. So he traded cars every 6 months and he wore New Balance shoes and he was a vegetarian. And you know what? And he always wore black mock turtlenecks. And so you look at these factors from the outside and then that produces Elizabeth Holmes, right? So I'm going to wear a black mock turtleneck. I'm going to rip people in public. I'm going to, you know, that does those external things are maybe visible about Steve Jobs, but that doesn't necessarily mean it caused him to be the great person he is.
Yeah.
So most people with black mock turtlenecks, jeans, driving Porsches or Mercedes and ripping people, they're not Steve Jobs. They're just assholes.
Right. Just your regular old common asshole. Yeah. That scammed, in her case, scammed a bunch of people.
Yeah, no kidding. Like, you know, the difference between Elizabeth Holmes and Steve Jobs is like, you know, Macintosh worked.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the Adam Newman type, you know, world where you're you feel like they're more glorifying themselves and this idea rather than forward this mission.
And I bring this point up in my book that I don't want people to think that this book is kind of the self-help book that, you know, I'm going to teach you how to reposition yourself and rebrand yourself and convince people you're remarkable. And at the extreme of that kind of self-help book and that kind of guru is, you know, you can come to my 2-day course at the Ritz-Carlton for $5,000. And, you know, in 2 days, I'm going to change your life and make you remarkable.
Yeah.
There's never going to be a Guy Kawasaki seminar like that. I promise you. Okay. And what it is that I think to be remarkable, it's because you made a difference. You've made the world a better place. Computers, Canva make the world a better place. You could be a high school coach, high school teacher.
Yeah.
It could be just a parent and you raise kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable. Mm-hmm. Trust me, I know. And so you don't have to be Steve Jobs or Jane Goodall to be remarkable. You just need to make a difference. And if enough people make a difference, this world will be a better place. So maybe it's registering people to vote. Who knows, right? Giving people water in line. Except in Georgia. So, you know, it's those kind of things. And so my perspective is this book is how to make a difference. And if you make a difference, people will label you remarkable. So the way it is you do something good, people will say you're remarkable. It's not because you decided, like, tomorrow. New Year's resolution, I'm going to be remarkable.
I will be remarkable.
Yeah. It ain't that easy. If it were that easy, more people would be remarkable.
Sure. Yeah, right. So there's three main sections of the book.
Yes.
There's growth, there's grit,
and grace.
There's grace, right? Is it a matter of age or like mindset, part of the journey that defines which of those stages you're currently on? Are they like a step one, step two, step three thing? Is it something that you're doing all three at once? How does that work?
I think it's roughly chronological, right? So you got to grow. You have to have a growth mindset. And to get the growth mindset going, you got to have grit.
Mm.
So growth and grit can make you successful.
Yeah.
But to truly be remarkable, you need grace. Because in the third part of your life, you realize that what you want to be remembered for is helping others.
Hmm.
And that's grace and graciousness. Like, I mean, Jimmy Carter. Even Bill Gates, God bless him, right? Like, Bill Gates He's not just living on a cruise ship with his 50-year-old, you know, new wife. He's trying to end malaria or whatever he's trying to do, right? And so, like, we'll see if Elon Musk ever becomes gracious. I'm not confident.
You're not sold.
I'm not sold, yeah. And so I think that's, you know, the last part of the test is... Mm. My father taught me this concept of noblesse oblige, that the nobility have an obligation to society. I think a better term today is success oblige.
Hmm.
Success oblige means when you're successful, you have an obligation to society. And, you know, you were lucky to go through some doors. Your job is not to shut the door behind you. Hmm. At least you should leave the door open. But even better, you should help more people get through that door. That's grace. Hmm. Right? And that's why people will remember you.
Is this part of what fuels you to continue doing all the, obviously you don't have to be doing any of the stuff that you do today.
Well, yeah, when you say that, you mean because I have it, the financial wherewithal to not do that.
Correct.
That's true. But in a sense, I have a different kind of force, which is, well, one is, what am I going to do? Just like play golf all day and watch Fox? You know, that, I just cannot do that. Yeah. But I think I have a moral obligation. And I did these 200 interviews and I said, you know, guy, there's so much great content in there from Angela Duckworth, Stephen Wolfram, Steve Wozniak, Bob Cialdini, you know, Jane Goodall, Stacey Abrams, Margaret Atwood, just go on and
take
on and
pick.
On.
Yeah, all
right, right. So like, there's so much good stuff in there. But you can't expect people to go listen to 200 hours to get that. And the way to do it is you write a book. And so the book represents humongous amount of filtering. So there's about 4,000 pages of transcripts because we transcribe everything for people because I'm deaf. Mm. I insist on transcripts. And maybe only 5 deaf people in the world are reading my transcripts, but yeah. I'm deaf, so I understand.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm not going to expect people to listen to 200 hours or read 4,000 pages. Mm. So this book is 170 pages. And it's because I have 40 years of real world, frontline, hand-to-hand combat experience to know what to filter.
Yeah.
So I don't think that someone, let's hypothetically say, someone who's 20 years old has conducted 200 interviews, it's not clear to me that that person would have the context to know what's important and what's bullshit in the 200 interviews.
I don't have as good of a bullshit filter.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It takes a while to develop a bullshit filter.
Sure. Yeah. A couple painful lessons and experiences along the way, probably. Yeah. Yeah. Getting screwed over one too many times, potentially. Seeing people go to prison, you know, things like that. People you used to believe in that, you know.
Don't meet your heroes.
Right, exactly. So now, obviously, you do all this work. You're writing you wrote the book, which is coming out very soon in March. And then you have the podcast, but you're also chief evangelist at Canva. You mentioned earlier chief evangelist at Apple. Can you define what the role of a chief evangelist is?
So evangelism comes from the Greek word meaning bring the good news. So I brought the good news of Macintosh. It would make you more creative and productive.
What did you coin this term when they hired you?
There was Jesus, and then there was a 2,000-year gap.
and then Guy Kawasaki's hired a Macintosh. Yeah.
No, so it's a Greek term. And, you know, Jesus bringing the good news of eternal life.
Sure. Well, I mean more in the context of like at a company.
Yeah, at a company. The first evangelist was Mike Boych. Okay. He's the guy who went to Stanford with me, who hired me, nepotism.
Got it.
So I'm the second evangelist, second secular evangelist.
Yeah.
And the concept was that rather than selling, you know, transactional, it was making people believe, to believe in Macintosh, that it was a way of life. It was thinking different. It was a belief that there is a better way and it can be done. And so we weren't just out there selling, you know, chips and rubber and steel and plastic and glass. We were trying to sell or evangelize a different way of looking at life. Hmm. And Canva is the same way. Canva is like saying that, you know, anybody can be a better communicator using Canva to create graphics. Mm-hmm. And that's about efficacy and the democratization of Photoshop and Illustrator. Yeah, you know, everybody can do this now. Same thing with Macintosh. Like, you didn't have to be an IT MIS expert to use a computer. Same thing.
How did the opportunity with Canva come about?
Oh, another great story. So I was big into Twitter when it started.
Okay.
And I had this theory that every tweet should go out with a graphic or a video to stand out, you know, in the valley of text messages. Mm-hmm. The one with pictures stands out.
Yeah.
So I was working with this woman named Peg Fitzpatrick, and she would be using Canva to make graphics for all my tweets.
Okay.
And one day, someone from Canva, one of the founders, Cliff, I believe, saw that I was using Canva mm-hmm. to tweet. And he reached out and said, you know, we notice you're using Canva. We would love to talk to you about, you know, possibly working together. So they found me. I didn't find them. And at the time, I was just fat, dumb, and happy consulting and speaking. And, you know, then they come up and I say to Peg, because I really, you know, I didn't know that much. I said, Peg, isn't Canva the company you use to make our graphics? She goes, yeah. I said, what, do you like it? She said, yeah. I said, do you think I should help them? She said, yeah, why not? That's why I got my job at Canva.
Wow. Okay.
Right. So if you think I looked at thousands of companies and I said, okay, this is the company that has the team and the technology and the market, go to Canva. Total bullshit.
Yeah.
Total. Is that what, rain?
It is. Yeah. It'll be a beautiful background aesthetic for this. It'll be great. It'll be great.
You know, it's funny, as a podcaster, we make so much effort. You know, you bring your Rodecaster. Yeah. You have these great, you know, Shure mics and all that. And and then you're going to go and edit and all that. And at the end of the day, somebody's listening in a car with the windows rolled down, going 65 miles an hour, and they're not going to hear anything. They barely hear the voices, right?
That's exactly right. Yep. We do it anyway.
But we do it because it's our shit sandwich.
We got to eat that shit sandwich. That's right. Somebody's got to. okay. So I know you said that the key to your heart is all about barbecue and surfing. I found that it was interesting that it took you going through a career at Apple and moving away from Hawaii to come to California to then eventually finally get into surfing. what was the purpose behind that? What was the reason behind that?
I can make the case that when I was growing up, I did not have a growth mindset, right? So I was good academically, you know, and I love football, but I didn't want to risk my self-image.
Yeah,
looking like a total doofus surfing.
Right.
So I took up surfing at 60.
60.
Which is 55 years too late. but that shows a growth mindset, right?
Yes.
That you can take up surfing at 60.
If you can take up a skill that in a sport at 60, at any sport.
Yeah. I mean,
is impressive.
I guess you could say that about pickleball, but
sure it's not as cool as surfing.
No,
yeah.
it's not nearly as hard.
Barbecue, what's your go-to order you go to a barbecue spot?
I've never met a rib I didn't like, actually.
Fair enough.
I'm going to South by Southwest in a month. I can't
wait.
Oh my
gosh. What's your favorite Austin barbecue spot?
Well, there's a what's the one you got to get in by 11 in the morning?
Oh,
it's not Lincoln.
I was just there like 2 weeks ago. and I stayed like literally 2 minutes from the spot. But yeah. I'm blank. Franklin's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Franklin's.
But you know what? I got to tell you, the Austin Airport barbecue is so good.
It's good, right? There's not barbecue there that I've had that I'm like, this is not good.
Yeah.
The Cooper's, yeah. Terry Black's, and you name it, I'm going to eat it.
You cannot go wrong.
Before I leave here, I'm going to get a recommendation from you on what barbecue I should have for dinner tonight.
Oh,
so,
Aptos barbecue.
Which one?
It's really raining, right? Aptos barbecue. Aptos.
Aptos.
Yeah.
Got it. I've been looking forward to dinner all day. So.
Man. I'm deaf and I can hear the rain, so it must really be coming down.
It is coming down, but I think these mics will help us avoid the background noise.
Okay.
He's giving me the nod. That's how I know.
We're good?
Like, yeah, because I don't know how these things work. I just
There's
show
a
up,
filter.
Yeah. Well, guy, listen, man, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. For those watching, listening again, Think Remarkable, 9 paths to transform your life and make a difference. I'm about 95% of the way through it. I think I have like 10, 12 pages left, the last chapter. And I can say that it is, what I really appreciate is how succinct you are, because sometimes, I think you even say this in the foreword, some self-help and like kind of business type books tend to be extraordinarily long for no reason at all. I appreciate when I can sit down in a single sitting and read through the majority of the book.
So I know. Thank you. There's 88 tactics in that book.
88.
Roughly 2 pages each.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of business books that take 200 or 300 pages to tell you one concept, right?
Yes.
Like,
I'm familiar.
What's the other 200 pages for?
It's a good question. Yeah. If you ever find the answer to that one, yeah, let me know. So thank you so much
for making that
succinct and really easy to, simple to digest, extremely practical, lots of great stories. And like I said, I'm a big fan of your work. Before I go, I got to ask you this question because this is how I came across your work to begin with, which was the 10-page pitch deck.
Yeah.
Where did that idea come from?
Okay, so I served the tour of duty as a venture capitalist.
Okay.
And holy shit. I mean, people show up with like 50 slides for a 50-minute meeting. I'm like, you cannot go through one slide per minute, right? And the font is about this big.
Yeah.
And they read the freaking slide. It was like making me crazy. That's why I'm deaf. It's all the shit pitches I listen to. It's an occupational hazard.
Your brain was doing you a favor.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so I figured out that, you know, there's only about 10. You got to talk about what you do, who you are, what the market is, how you're going to introduce it. You know, it's not 60 slides. And I think that, to use a dating analogy, this world in investing and making decisions, there's a spectrum in dating. So at one end, there's eHarmony, and you fill out 27 fields of psychographic information because you're going to find your soulmate and you're going to be walking, holding hands on windswept beaches, holding champagne glasses, right? At the other end, there's Tinder, hot, not. Life is like Tinder. You're going to decide, hey, read this book, don't read this book, fund this company, don't fund this company. And so I think, especially now, you have to prepare people to make Tinder-like decisions, not eHarmony. If I expected people to read 20 pages of that book before they bought it, I'm not going to sell it.
Right. They're going to look at the cover.
They're going to look at
maybe the about the author section and make a decision.
On online, they're going to say, oh, 4.9 stars.
Right.
One click in my basket, right?
Yep.
That's how it is.
Appreciate it.
So 10, 20, 30 is 10 slides. You should be able to give those 10 slides in 20 minutes, even though you think you have an hour. And the 30 point is to force you to put as little text as possible.
As little on the slide as you possibly can put.
Yeah, because you don't want people reading the slide. You want people looking back at you.
Yes.
So just put a few words on the slide and look back at the presenter. That's where the action is. Not, you don't want them, you know, okay.
Yeah, well, sometimes you might even forget to say the whole thing, and then they think they missed something.
Yeah.
You know, you move to the next slide and like, oh, what did you say? And it's like, oh, well, that wasn't important because I know what it is.
Well, if it's not important, why is it on the slide?
Yeah, right, exactly. Good question. God, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for taking the time. We'll
Thank
get you,
you
out of here and on to your next thing. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks for spending some time with me and my friends. If you want to be better friends with me, then head over to travischappell.com/team to subscribe to my free newsletter, Your Friend Travis, where I share what's on my mind about life, building a business, raising kids, being married, and anything else I would normally share with my close circle of friends. That's travischappell.com/team. And my biggest ask of you, since I'm sharing my friends with you, is to share this episode with a friend of yours that hasn't listened to the show yet. Then leave us a quick 5-star rating in Apple Podcasts and in Spotify. It would mean the world to us as it helps us make sure that this show continues to be more valuable to you. Thanks in advance, and I'll catch you on the next episode.